The following recording was produced by Christ Redeemer Church of Hanover, New Hampshire. The speaker is Doug Cooper. You may find more information on the church and its various resources on the web at www.christredeemerchurch.org.
Psalm 24, a Psalm of David. The earth is the Lord's in the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false. I looked up and lost my place. And does not swear deceitfully. He will receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek the face of God, of Jacob, Salah. Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is the King of glory? The Lord, strong and mighty. The Lord, mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O gates, and lift them up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. Salah. Thus ends the reading of God's word.
Thank you, Sue. All right. Well, I don't know if everybody who's here was here last Sunday, but last Sunday we got started with our sermon series for the summer, Summer in the Psalms. It's a bit of a tongue twister right there. One of the things that I said, you guys still hear me okay? One of the things that I said when we were here last week as I was getting us kicked off was that psalms are essentially thought of as songs or as poems. And as I've been spending some time with this particular psalm this week, I have tended to think of it more like a poem. Not that it is, but I guess it's because, like a lot of poems, there's a bit of mystery contained in this particular psalm, which is not to say that it's hard to grasp. I don't think that it is hard to grasp. I think it's actually quite accessible. It's very direct. It teaches us plainly even about very specific things about God, very specific things about ourselves. And so it's not mysterious in those sorts of ways. But to me, here's the mystery. Where are we? Like, is this psalm is being read, you might think to yourself, Where am I right now? Because with a lot of the psalms that we get little tidbits, you know, just places, circumstances, situations that tend to tell you where it is that a psalm is coming to life from. But we don't get that so much with this. Some assume that this psalm is referring to a scene documented in First Chronicles where David leads a procession of people as they return the stolen Ark of the Covenant back to the ownership of the people of Israel. And that may be true. I mean, I could see that. I really could. In fact, I'm gonna bring that circumstance back up a little bit later. But that said, to assume that that's definitely what's going on here, I think would be a bit speculative because we really don't have too much to go on. And let me do this. I'm just going to scroll through the psalm and just kind of pick up on some of the contextual components that are there so you can see what I'm talking about. So right out of the gate, we're told that it's a psalm of David. So we do know that, and that's great. I mean, that's helpful. However, what we do know of the 150 psalms that we've got, David wrote nearly half of them. So in essence, it doesn't tell us too much. David speaks of the hill of the Lord. Okay. That could mean several things. He speaks of his holy place, God's holy place. Again, that could mean several things, really. Tough to know specifically what David has in mind when he says that. And then the only other thing that we get is like a point of context comes in verses 7 and 9, where he mentions ancient doors. And this is perhaps the most interesting and mysterious descriptor of them all. Other translations refer to them as everlasting doors or gates of eternity. So, whoa, well, you know, what's that about? And again, where are we? Like, where are we right now?
It's a good question to ask. What's the location of this psalm? Still don't know. This could be alluding to a real situation in a particular time and place, perhaps in the past, like the one that I just mentioned. Could be alluding to a future event, a future reality beyond this world. Could be both. Not entirely sure, but I tend to think that ultimately this is referring to both of those things, actually. And that both are extremely significant. So take this phrase, ancient doors, or everlasting doors, gates of eternity, because that, I think, is a big clue to us signaling, perhaps, that we're dealing with something of epic proportions, something that is quite big. And by the way, this gate reference that we have got here, what's it about? You know, what are we told about these ancient everlasting doors? And it's worth noting that they're mentioned twice, in the same exact way, which is essentially a literary device. It's a way of emphasizing, of showing importance, significance. But again, why are they mentioned? Why are the gates mentioned? Please look back with me at verse 9. Lift up your heads, O gates, and lift them up, O ancient doors. Well, why? That the King of Glory may come in. And then we get a question, verse 10. Who is this King of Glory? And right here, we're getting warmer. In terms of what's this epic proportional thing that's going on here? We're getting warmer because that's the question to answer. Who is this King? Who is this King of Glory? And let's not overlook the obvious, you know, because David does answer the question, right? I mean, we could just answer the question and just stop right there. But verse 10, who is this King of Glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of Glory. And then it ends with Selah, or Selah. I think you can pronounce it both ways, which many believe to be some kind of a musical term, a musical mark intended to imply a pause. This is what people speculate. Perhaps a command to pause and reflect, which would make a whole lot of sense because we just got this double whammy of emphasis. So it would make sense to then say, okay, I've said this, now pause and just take a moment to reflect on what you just heard. Who is this King of Glory? It's the Lord. He is the King of Glory. Pause, reflect, right? And yet, I think we're being called to reflect not just that statement that I just read, but we're supposed to reflect on all that we just heard about him. So who is this King of Glory specifically, not just generally? And that's what we're after this morning, okay? He is described for us in many ways here, and I will mention three broad ways that he is described for us. One, this king is described in action. He's doing stuff. Okay, what is he doing? We'll look at that. Two, this king is described in contrast. In particular, he's described in contrast to us. So we'll consider that. And then lastly, number three, this king is described in terms of his glory, King of Glory. So what is his glory specifically? You know, what is his ultimate splendor and majesty? And so we'll end off considering that. So again, three things, king described in terms of action, contrast, glory. Okay, so who is he? Who is this King of Glory? Let's find out. To begin with, this king is described in action. But what kind of action? Please look back with me at verses 1 and 2. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on in these two verses. I'm going to reread it. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. And I'm just going to stop right there for a moment. So the first thing that we're told here is that the earth is the Lord's. It belongs to him, presently, right now, not just back then. It's not yours. It's not mine. It's his. It belongs to him. Well, okay, what belongs to him specifically? What are we talking about? And it says the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein, aka all of it, the whole kit and caboodle. It all belongs to him. The fullness thereof is how it's expressed. That's interesting. And just in case we might get confused about the implications of what that might entail, the fullness thereof. David is very careful to remind us that fullness thereof includes you and me. All right? It includes us. We belong to him. He's our cosmic king, which means that we're to live our lives in light of him, before him, reflectively. You know, pause and reflect. But wait a minute, why? Why? Well, let's have a look at verse 2. For, so there's our cause, because he has founded it. Well, how much? How much of it? How much? All of it. He's founded all of it, the fullness thereof. That's how much. For he founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. And that word established there, that comes to us in what you call a continuous present tense. A continuous present tense, meaning he established it and he continues to establish it. All right? And he continues to establish it. Here's another way of putting it. He created it and he's sustaining it. He made the sun, right? And because of him, the sun keeps right on shining. He created the trees, and because of his active engagement with his creation, the trees keep right on growing. They keep reproducing themselves. They keep putting down roots. They keep reproducing leaves year in and year out, providing us with that precious O2. Or is it O? O2. That's our earth science in-house professor. Thank you. I knew I could count on you, Craig. O2. All right. He's the cosmic king, the king of glory. I mean, just stop to think. Let's just stick with trees for a minute. I love trees. Let's just stick with trees. Never mind anything else. Think about this. What if trees, all of them, just suddenly ceased from existing? Okay? What would happen? If tomorrow all the trees were just gone. As I wondered about this, and I did, I was just like, what would happen, you know? I tracked down an article put out by the BBC in 2019 that actually sought to answer this very question that I had. It was perfect. And they interviewed just a whole host of ecologists from all over the world. And so I'm just going to share a couple of excerpts from that just to consider, like, you know, what are the implications of just the intricate involvement of trees on our planet? So, quote, the planet's climate would be drastically altered in the short and long term. Trees. So it's beginning to talk about like how they operate in our ecosystem. Trees mediate the water cycle by acting as biological pumps. They suck water from the soil and deposit it into the atmosphere by transforming it from liquid to vapor. By doing this, forests contribute to cloud formation and precipitation. Trees also prevent flooding by trapping water rather than letting it rush into lakes and rivers, and by buffering coastal communities from storm surges. They keep soil in place that would otherwise wash away in the rain, and their root structures help microbial communities thrive. And here's just a little bit more on this. This is interesting. Without trees, formerly forested areas would become drier and more prone to extreme droughts. When rain did come, flooding would be disastrous. Massive erosion would impact oceans, smothering coral reefs and other marine habitats. Islands stripped of trees would lose their barriers to the oceans, and many would be washed away. And, I mean, you can imagine, I'm not going to read all of this for you, but you can imagine where this article is heading. It's essentially telling us that ultimately, without trees, life on our planet would eventually become unsustainable. Not merely for lack of oxygen, which is the only thing that I'm just being honest here. I'm not a scientist. That's the only thing that really crossed my mind as I thought about this is just like, no trees. Like, that's really going to mess up the oxygen situation and we're really going to be in trouble. But I mean, there's just so much more to it. It's such, so much more intricate than that. Because of the incredible, intricate role that trees play in the grand scheme of God's design. And that's not how they put it in this article, but that's how I'm putting it. That, I mean, this is mind blowing stuff. God's creation is vulnerable in so many ways. Like if you just remove the trees, all that would happen, right? And yet it's uniquely crafted in such a way that it holds together beautifully, and yet it is utterly dependent upon God's ongoing sustaining power. He keeps it up. In fact, here's one more statement from this article that plays right into our text. Thomas Crowther, a leading global systems ecologist from Switzerland, says, and he puts this very simply, removing trees means losing huge amounts of land to the ocean. Removing trees means losing huge amounts of land to the ocean. And listen, I don't know if all of this data that I'm sharing with you is 100% accurate. I'm not an ecologist by any stretch. But on this particular point about the importance and role of trees and the intricacies of God's creation, this stuff just makes a whole lot of sense to me. And here's the big reason why. Because what doesn't make sense is that it all works in the first place. Just like, how does this even work, right? Because verse 2 again, "For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers." I mean, why does David put it like this? Why does he say it this way? This is an odd way for making an argument for a foundation. You know what I mean? Like, it's founded on water. It's like, what? In Genesis 1, we read that the water separated and that land emerged. Here, David tells us that God founded life, I'm talking about like land life, upon water. And either way you want to think about that, I think that the point remains the same, that this is all just utterly breathtaking. This is amazing. I mean, how is it that the earth doesn't just crumble into the salty sea at any given moment? Like, how has that not already happened? Like, how do these two things stay separated from one another? You know, and really, it's a demonstration of God's incredible providence, his unique design. The word seas here, at the root of that word, it has the idea of roaring, noisy surf. Okay, one contemporary Bible scholar picked up on this and said, "Used here of ocean tides, the movement of the sea, seen as a constant threat to the stability of the creation, therefore needing the constant vigilance and ongoing care of the Creator God." Or similarly, an older Bible scholar by the name of Joseph Benson put it this way: "This is here mentioned as an evidence of God's wise and gracious providence, that he hath erected so vast a building upon so weak a foundation as the waters are." All right? Just developing strength from weakness. God loves to do this sort of thing, it seems. In other words, this is something that only he can do, and he does, and he continues to do it because he's the cosmic king, he's the Lord of heaven and earth, and he demonstrates his stature. So I'm just panning out from trees now, we're going bigger. He demonstrates his stature as the king of all creation in endless ways, every moment of every day, going all the way back to ancient days of old, all the way up to the very present moment, right here and right now. He's perpetually doing this sort of thing. In him, all things hold together, we're told. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made, including you and I. He created us. He's sustaining us right now. And I mean, I don't mean to express this in such a scary way, but I mean, your next breath, your heartbeat, he's sustaining you right now by his providence, graciously. But he isn't just described in terms of action. He's also described as the king in terms of contrast. But how so? Please look back with me, beginning at verse 3. David poses this question to us, or probably more accurately, we could say that God is posing this question to us. Verse 3, "Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place?" And this is essentially, this is just one question that is being put to us in like two slightly different ways, but it's really one question. And we get the answer to this question in verse 4. Who can do these things? "He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false and does not swear deceitfully." And so let's just stop right there and think on this for a minute, okay? To start with, when it says, "Who shall stand in his holy place," in verse 3 there, some have pointed out that this word "stand" is sometimes used as a courtroom term. Okay. You know, kind of like, you know, "Would the defendant please take their stand?" That should sound familiar to us. And I'll give you some for instances. And I'm just going to stay with the Psalms since we're in the Psalms. Psalm 1 verse 5, we read this. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in judgment. And you can hear the courtroom language imagery being used here, except that this is not in reference to a human court, is it? What I just read there. This is actually in reference to standing before the judgment seat of God. We're told that the wicked will not stand in judgment. They will have no defense. They've got no legs to stand on. You know, you've heard people say, you know, that guy, man, he hasn't got a leg to stand on. That's what we're talking about. Here's another one. Psalm 27, we hear David praying this time. And in verse 12 of Psalm 27, David says to the Lord, "Do not turn me over to the desire of my foes, for false witnesses rise up against me, spouting malicious accusations." So more courtroom language for us. And in this case, when it says rise up against me, same word there, so that it could read something like this. False witnesses are taking their stand against me and are spouting malicious accusations. False testimony. I object, you know, judge. And this is the idea here in our psalm in verse 3. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place? And so what we're being asked here is, really, who can take their stand before God? Who can take their stand before God in his holy place, in his holy presence? Who can do that? Who can declare themselves innocent before the Creator and the Sustainer of the universe? Who can do that? Who can claim to have clean hands? Who can claim to have a pure heart? Who can claim that they haven't lifted their souls, given themselves over to what is false? And whoever can, this is what we're told here, whoever can rightfully make that claim, verse 5 tells us that they'll receive blessing and righteousness from the Lord. And I'm hoping, along with me here, that we're all seeing at this point that this is a tricky set of verses that we've got right here. And here's one reason why. Because Proverbs chapter 20, verse 8 and 9 comes to my mind. This involves, in verse 8, it's talking about a king. And then in verse 9, it's talking about us. So kind of a similar situation, actually. It says this, "When a king sits on his throne to judge, he winnows out all evil with his eyes." Sounds kind of funny. He's saying, like, he sifts it out. He identifies what's unclean. He identifies what's impure. The judge does. It's his job, okay? And then it says, verse 8, who can say, verse 9 rather, who can say, "I have kept my heart pure. I am clean and without sin." Who can say? I mean, this is a rhetorical question. You know, like, who can say that? In other words, nobody can say that, right? So you, hopefully you're seeing now just like, how does this jibe with what we're reading here in Psalm 24? And certainly David, the author of Psalm 24, well, he can't say that, right? He can't make the claim that he can't stand by the claim that he's making. In one breath, right here, he's saying, this is the one who can take their stand in God's holy place. The one who has clean hands and a pure heart, they'll receive God's blessing. They'll receive God's righteousness. And then in another breath, if you were and I were to jump ahead to Psalm 51 then, you'd hear David saying this. And let me just give it some context. There's a little subtitle that comes at the top of Psalm 51, and it reads like this. A Psalm of David, when the prophet Nathan came to him after David had committed adultery with Bathsheba. And there's a whole lot to it, to that. You know, there's a lot more dirt connected to that little contextual note. And, but this Psalm 51 captures a moment in David's life when he's bowing. He's bowing before the Lord and agonizing over the weight of his sin, agonizing over the guilt of his sin. He isn't standing, right? He knows, I don't have a leg to stand on. I need to bow down here, okay? And this is some of what he says. "Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion. Blot out my transgressions." And then compare what comes next to the language of Psalm 24, all right? He then says, "Wash away all my iniquity. My hands are not clean My heart is not pure. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. Verse 7, cleanse me. I mean, it just keeps coming. Cleanse me with hyssop and I will be clean. Wash me and I will be whiter than snow. Or listen to his request here, verse 10. Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. I need you to recreate me, God. I need you to recreate me, O God of all creation. He goes on to say, verse 12, restore to me the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. All right. I need you to recreate me, God. And then I need you to sustain me after you're done doing that. I need both, you know. You know, when people order a hot dog and they say, give me the works. By the way, do you guys do that? Do you guys get the works when you get a hot dog? Any brave souls out there? No. This is what David's saying. He's saying, Lord, give me the works. Like, I need it all. Like, I need everything you got. I need the whole kit and caboodle. I'm a man of unclean hands. I'm a man with an impure heart. I'm a man who frequently lifts his soul to that which is false. Please break into my life and give me the works. I need the creator and sustainer of the universe to do a complete overhaul of my life, to recreate me and sustain me. And if I could be so bold, is to ask us, is a group of people here, when was the last time that you cried out to God in this particular kind of fashion? Just recognizing your own inability to ascend his hill, your own inability to stand before him. Just recognizing, God, I don't have a leg to stand on here. Oh, how I need you. Wash me, cleanse me, recreate me, sustain me. When was the last time you cried out to God in this manner? Staying with this ocean metaphor, I'm just going to try to drill down on this a little bit. Staying with this ocean metaphor, the contrast that separates us from him is as wide and as deep as the ocean itself, okay? That's an understatement, actually. If God were the ocean itself, there wouldn't be one single drop of impurity within the entirety of the ocean. Not one. His hands are altogether clean. His heart is altogether pure. And it only takes, you realize, it only takes one drop. One drop of impurity taints the whole. And in order for us to stand in his holy presence, that is the standard. Purity. That's the standard. I mean, I hope you recognize the dilemma here. I mean, you're thinking to yourself, come on, Doug. Lighten up, man. I'm not so bad. You know, I'm a good guy. You know, I'm a good son. I'm a good sister. I love my family. I hand out Christmas cards each year. I recycle, you know, I pay my bills on time. I play well with others. I share. Cut me some slack here, you know. If we're understanding this well, here's how the contrast ought to shock us. The contrast that exists between us. This is how it ought to shock us. Okay, so it would be like someone coming to you and saying, hey, I've got a job. I need a good swimmer. Any good swimmers out there? And you're like, sweet. You know, like I could use a job and I'm a great swimmer. I was on the high school swim team. I tend to swim circles around people. You know, I could do this. And the person, and so you're like, yeah, sign me up. I'm in. And then the person says, okay, great. I need you to take this package and swim it to China for me. About how long do you think that's going to take you so I can report back to my supervisor? You know, it's just like, wait, what? You need me to do what? I mean, it's laughable. I mean, who can do that? Nobody can do that, right? And we don't see it, but that's how unclean our hands actually are. That's the contrast. That's how impure our hearts actually are. That's how great the contrast really is between us and him, because he's holy. Who can ascend his holy hill? Who can stand in his holy presence? He's altogether pure. Altogether clean. In so many subtle ways, these things, I think, just fly right under our radar. Like we don't see it We don't see it. But to him, it's all, I mean, he sees it. You know, it's all just as plain and as crystal clear to him as I am to you standing up here right here and right now. Like that, that's how unclouded his accuracy is in recognizing what dwells within each of us. He sees all the secret sins of your heart, all right? He recognizes all of my pathetic maneuvers that I'm making all the time that are oblivious to me. I don't even see it. He sees it, all right? And yet, and this is the kicker, this is going to bring us into our last point, and yet, even though this is true, what I just said, yet he still pursues us with his unfailing love. That's the upshot of the psalm. He still pursues us with his unfailing love. So now lastly, the king described in glory. If the scene that I mentioned earlier, if there's a connection here, the scene in which David is leading a procession of people back to the gates of their city with the Ark of the Covenant in his possession, that connection, if it does make sense, it makes sense once we get to verse number 7. So look back with me at verse number 7. And some imagine, like, what's going on from 7 down. Some imagine that this is like a call and response that's happening here from one side of the gates to the other. That there's people on that side of the gate and this side of the gate, and they're kind of like talking to each other. So verse 7 is the people outside of the gate, okay? Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. And then the guard on the other side responds, who is this King of Glory? And then they reply, the Lord, strong and mighty, the Lord, mighty in battle. And then once more, lift up your heads, O gates, and lift them up, O ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. Who is this King of Glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of Glory. Right? And then you might imagine, if we're going to keep running with this, then you might imagine that the gates open up, okay? And this procession of people then begins to enter the city with the Ark of the Covenant, riding on the train, you could say, riding upon the train of the presence of God into the city, okay? And this right here, this idea that I'm expressing here, whether or not this is connected back to David or not, but this idea right here, this is the only way to ascend that holy hill. Who can ascend the hill of the Lord? Who has clean hands and a pure heart? In coming into the New Testament, we're told who. This is from Hebrews chapter 4. We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things, just as we are, yet without sin. With pure hands, with a pure heart. Or as Peter put it, here's another one. You know that it was not with perishable things such as silver or gold that we were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to us from our ancestors, but it was with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. Clean hands, pure heart. Who is this King of Glory? Jesus is. You guys probably saw that coming, huh? Who is this King of Glory? Jesus is. He's the only one worthy enough to pass through the eternal gates. In fact, if you take a close look at the Gospels, we just set aside the Gospel of John for a little while, but I'm going to actually dip us right back into it here for a minute. In John 10, we hear Jesus saying that he's the gate, actually. This is interesting pairing of metaphors and so on. Jesus says this, "Very truly I tell you, I am the gate. For the sheep, I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved," he says. "They will come in and go out and find pasture." Well, now how? How is that possible? Well, you just got to jump down a couple more verses, and he tells us how. "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep." That's what he says. And this is his glory, okay? This is his glory, that the creator and sustainer lays down his life. That the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. This is his glory. Not that he ascends the hill of the Lord, but rather that he descends the hill of the Lord. Okay. On this theme of being the good shepherd, we also read this in the Gospels. I actually snatched this up from John Willimon when he shared his testimony at the Father and Son Campout the other day. I was just like, wow, I never noticed that before. This is really interesting. on this theme of him being the good shepherd, we read in Matthew 18, this comes from Matthew 18, we get one of the parables of Jesus. He asks, what do you think? If any man has 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, will he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go and search for the one that is lost? And if it turns out that he finds it, truly I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that have not gone astray. So it is not the will of your Father who is in heaven for one of these little ones to perish. What is he saying? What is he talking about? He's saying the good shepherd leaves the hill. The good shepherd leaves the hill country and comes down into the valley in search of the lost sheep and then brings them back up the hill with him. All right? He pursues us in our sin, even to the point of death. The hill that Jesus did ascend, okay, what would that be? He ascended Calvary. He ascended Golgotha. He ascended the place of the skull that we might receive the blessing and the righteousness of the God of our salvation. Okay. And so, I mean, maybe a thought for us to take away from Psalm 24 this morning is, what are you looking to? How are you ascending the hill of the Lord? What is it that makes you think that you can stand in his holy place? And my encouragement to us is, we have no standing. That doesn't sound very encouraging. But in him, we do. In the Lord Jesus Christ, we have a way to stand. In the Lord Jesus Christ, we have a way to ascend. Right? And the product of this is like the removal of most burdens that you're bearing, probably. Because we're all doing this ascending work all the time. Just like hustle, hustle, hustle. I got to make it happen. And in essence, we're just trying to prove ourselves to say, I'm righteous. Do you see? Any arguments? I'm righteous. No, he's righteous. Like David, we should bow before him. Let me pray. Father, thank you so much for just one more really intricate, neat picture that you give us that points us back to your son. God, I pray that we would gladly bow before our good shepherd in our hearts this morning. I pray that as we continue on with our confession of faith, with our song, with our day, Lord, that our hearts would be singing to him. It's in his name we pray. Amen.